From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the March 2019 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, From Casino to Kohima. In this It Happened Here episode, we go back to the spring of 1944, when much of Europe, and indeed the world, held its breath awaiting the second front in Europe. This would be realised in June, when Operation Overlord, the D-Day landings, began in France. During that spring, however, British and Allied troops were involved in some of the fiercest fighting of the war in Italy and in the Far East, as the tide finally turned against the Japanese in Burma. The Codebreakers at Bletchley Park continued to support these operations and were able to achieve some of their most significant successes yet against both German and Japanese codes and ciphers. As usual, our guide to these events is Dr. David Kenyon, Bletchley Park's research historian.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, in the last It Happened Here episode, we left off as things were heating up on the Italian front. Can you give us a bit of background about what was going on there?
75 years ago this month would have been the spring of 1944. A lot of people now are looking forward to the 75th anniversary of D-Day and the events in Western Europe. But we have to remember that British troops and Allied troops were very heavily involved in fighting in other parts of the world throughout 1943 and into 1944. And the Italian campaign in the spring of 1944 reaches a real peak of intensity, particularly around the battles along the Gustav Line and famously at Monte Cassino.
What led up to those battles?
Well, the invasion of Italy in 1943, put simply, the Allies invade Sicily and then land on the toe of Italy and start working their way north through Italy. The Italians themselves have surrendered, effectively agreed to an armistice in September of 1943, but the Germans still garrison Italy very heavily. So even though the Italians aren't fighting, there's lots of Germans fighting in Italy. The immediate objective for the spring of 1944 was to capture Rome. Rome was as much a political objective as it was a military objective, but it was a good landmark to go for at that point. The problem was that Kesselring, the German commander in Italy, knew that and had established defences from coast to coast, sort of laterally across Italy, somewhat south of Rome. There's a position which is known as the Winter Line because it was established in late 1943 into early 1944. And at the heart of that is a defensive position codenamed the Gustav Line. Italy at that point is very mountainous, so it's very good defensive country. You have relatively few axes of advance up Italy, if you like, towards Rome. One of those in particular is Highway 6, and this is a road that cuts through the mountains, more or less in the middle of Italy, if you like, and leads up to Rome. And so the Germans had built a whole series of very heavy defensive positions there. In the middle of those positions is Monte Cassino. Cassino is famous historically because it is a Benedictine monastery, but not only was it a Benedictine monastery, but it was the monastery that St. Benedict actually established, so it has a very, very long religious history. The monastery itself is set on top of a very vertiginous mountain, and the building itself is a huge stone-built 10-foot-thick wall structure. And so, from the point of view of the advancing Allies, Monte Cassino looked like the key point in these defences. You couldn't advance up Highway 6 and up the Liri Valley until Cassino was in Allied hands.
Were they confident that they could take Cassino, though?
They knew it was going to be tricky, and the extent to which the Germans had dug in this already rugged terrain was going to make it even more difficult. So they had to come up with a very deliberate plan. They had to devote all their effort to breaking through this line in order to move on to Rome. And the second part of the plan, because they know the fight against the Gustav Line is going to be difficult, is to outflank it. There's a secondary plan, which is to launch an amphibious operation going round the end of the line and landing on the Italian coast further north. And they settle on Anzio as the location for that landing. And the idea is that once the Germans have been tied down at Cassino, then a landing behind them, they can then cut across and basically cut off all those troops from Rome and make massive progress.
Hello, BBC. Wilfred Vaughan Thomas speaking with Herbert Walden recording. That's the sound of the first sound of our own ACAC, and it's a sign that the usual night raid on our positions here is coming in. Right above us, the sky has suddenly become as bright as day. The German flares are burning, hanging almost motionless overhead in the night sky, and a shower of glittering silver light coming down from them. Here on the ground, we feel as if we were standing under the flares on a fairground. Every tree, every house seems clearly lit up, and our old black is getting furious and fierce. First bomb's going down, it's away to the left of us, but even back here, the ground around is shaking viciously, and Weldon's recording truck now rocking on its springs.
How successful were they in this sort of two-pronged pincer movement then?
The simple answer is not very. The fighting that begins in January around Cassino and indeed at Anzio continues right through until the end of May, and Rome itself is not captured until the beginning of June. Ironically, it's captured 2 days before D-Day, and while it might have been a bigger deal in the newspapers, the fact that the Normandy invasion happened 2 days later has led to it rather being sort of overshadowed in sort of popular consciousness. But basically from January to May, there are no fewer than four phases of major assault on Monte Cassino by the Americans and then by the British 8th Army, which in fact includes troops from other places. So you have a big Polish contingent, you have Indian troops in large numbers, there's French troops there, there's Moroccan troops there, there's also some New Zealanders involved as well. So there's all sorts of different soldiers being brought to bear. It's a really international battle. But they all have the same problem, which is they have to scale these steep, rugged, scrub-covered mountains in the face of very stiff German defence. There's also rivers at the foot of the mountains, and there are a couple of opposed river crossings which have to be made. So the whole thing is a really hard-fought battle.
What was the outcome of the battle?
Well, we're going to revisit this story later in the year because the final successful phase of the operation wasn't until May of 1944. But the early period is characterised by very, very fierce fighting. And one of the more controversial aspects of the campaign was that because the monastery occupied such a dominating position, overlooking the valley and overlooking all the Allied positions, there was a view that the Germans were potentially using the abbey as an artillery observation point and basically a strong point in the defences. Actually, the Germans had taken some trouble not to occupy the monastery because they knew the political ramifications of its destruction. And in fact, fortunately, they had evacuated a lot of the art and the whole library and everything else had all been packed up and shipped to the Vatican before the battle began, just for safety. And this was just as well, because in mid-February, the Allies decided that they should bomb the monastery buildings because they were worried that they'd be used defensively. This was quite counterproductive because there were no Germans in the monastery at the time, and turning it into a heap of rubble with cellars underneath actually made it into a much more defensible position. And the German response was, well, if they bombed it anyway, we might as well occupy it. So the monastery buildings were then occupied by German troops, and not just any German troops, they were occupied by German paratroops who were very high quality soldiers. So the Allies actually make the fight harder for themselves in that way.
The Germans, throwing heavy reserves of men and machines at the Allied lines below Rome, have again been smashed back. Four assaults in all, constituting the long-awaited full-scale German counterattack, have snapped under the concentration of Allied power. Our beachhead is now 2 weeks old, during which time we have advanced an average of about 6 miles inland. The width of that beachhead is around 20 miles. In that area, just south of the Italian capital, some of the bitterest battles of the Italian campaign are raging. The Germans are determined to make us pay heavily for every yard of advance. The Battle of Italy is to them more than just another campaign. The Nazis look upon our thrust in Italy as the placing of the first Allied nail in Hitler's coffin. And they're right.
The other thing that doesn't go quite as well as planned is the landing at Anzio. There are relatively few places where you can have an amphibious landing on the west coast of Italy around Rome. And they're looking for a beach that they can land on. The one they choose at Anzio, unfortunately, is backed by the Pontine Marshes, an area which basically for centuries was malarial swamp. And it was drained by Mussolini to turn it into agricultural land in the 1930s. But it wasn't a great spot. And it's also surrounded by mountains. So the landing happened and there was very little German opposition to the landing itself. And the troops got ashore quite successfully. Unfortunately, the American general Lucas, who's in charge of the landings, doesn't push on inland once he's got his troops ashore. He basically kind of digs in near the beach. And this allows the Germans to get back in and reinforce the mountains around it. And instead of cutting off the Germans from the rear, the troops at Anzio end up essentially in a siege. They're trapped in this marsh surrounded by Germans. And they don't actually break out from there in a significant way until after Cassino has actually fallen later on. It's caused a lot of discussion amongst historians because when the landing happened, there were so few German defences that some troops in jeeps were actually able to drive to Rome, which is probably only an hour up the road.
Goodness.
And kind of drive around Rome and go, hey, we're in Rome, and then drive back again.
Is the question then, why didn't everybody do that?
That's the argument. At the time, Lucas and others defended themselves saying, actually, if the troops had extended themselves that far, German counterattacks probably would have defeated them, and that it was actually a bit too far to go straight away. But there's no doubt that Lucas should have pushed on more vigorously and could have made a lot more difference if he'd been a bit more bold in the first hours of the operation.
The Germans continue to throw reinforcements into the two furious battles now going on across the Atlantic in Italy. For a direct report on the latest developments in that the Mediterranean war zone, Winston Burdett reporting.
While bitter seesaw fighting continues on our beachhead south of Rome, the Germans are bringing fresh reinforcements into Cassino to stiffen their house-by-house resistance in that key stronghold of the main Fifth Army front. This afternoon, CBS correspondent Farnsworth Powell watched the battle for Cassino from a rocky vantage point overlooking the Rapido and Garigliano rivers. Inside the town, Powell says, our tank and infantry teams have dug the Germans out of a few more houses since yesterday. Both inside and out, an earth-shaking artillery duel was raging this afternoon. Our shells were whistling into the central and southern part of Cassino. They were aiming at German batteries in the hills west of the Garigliano. Already, they were reaching out to blast the next important road junction westward up the Liri Valley. Their main target was a rocky knoll rising a couple of hundred feet behind Cassino with a medieval castle on top. Last night, our infantry attacked that knoll, but were driven back by German units holding on behind the heavy castle walls with plenty of small arms. Shortly after noon today, Fowle says, we tried again. Everything landed on the castle all at once. A concentrated barrage of more than 100 field guns, including some of very heavy caliber. When the barrage was over, the castle tower was still standing. And later this afternoon, our infantry was attacking again. Our troops are meeting the same ferocious resistance in the hills north of Cassino, where the enemy is counterattacking often and heavily. To the south of Rome, we are still holding on to the perimeter defenses of our beachhead. The German force there is several divisions strong and includes some crack SS troops, the first we have met in the line in Italy. Fowle reports that the Germans have at least 8 divisions divided between the beachhead and the Cassino sector alone. The news today is that the Germans are hitting back heavily with almost everything they have in those 2 sectors. And now back to CBS in New York.
Obviously, we are familiar with the Bletchley Park perspective of the Second World War, and that's what we like to bring into these podcasts. Can you tell me what the role of Bletchley Park was in Monte Cassino and Anzio and all these actions?
Well, the latter part of 1943 and the early part of 1944 is a very productive time for Bletchley Park. The German communications in Italy were being very effectively intercepted and read. And we'll be talking later in the year about the intelligence success around D-Day. But actually, a lot of this success is sort of prefigured, if you like, by what they're doing in Italy. And this separates into a number of different cryptological threads. Enigma, of course, is still Bletchley's bread and butter. And in Italy, it's particularly effective because in 1943, the Germans adopt a new policy where, in order to improve coordination between their army and their air force, the Luftwaffe create liaison officers who are called Fliegerverbindungsoffiziers. Their role is to keep the two in contact. So each major German army formation has a Fleivo, as they're called in German. And on almost a daily basis, he's reporting back using Enigma to the Luftwaffe on what the army are doing so that they can support it with bombing or air operations or whatever.
And that was frequently being intercepted.
And that's being intercepted very, very readily by Bletchley. So the Luftwaffe are effectively sending a daily report on what the army are up to, which is extremely useful for Bletchley. And there are several Fleivo networks. One codenamed Puma in particular is the one that relates to Italy. And they're reading that traffic really, really successfully. Above that, you have Lorenz traffic, the famous fish intercepts. And there's a link from Berlin to Rome, to Kesselring's headquarters in Rome, codenamed by Bletchley Bream, because they're all named after fish. And Bream is read more or less consistently from May 1943 onwards. So they're getting a huge amount of both high-level information about what Kesselring's planning, but also detailed administrative information about the German forces themselves from that source. It has a number of implications. The first is the ability to read Kesselring's discussions with Berlin is very important because Churchill is fighting a rearguard action against the Americans to continue the campaign in Italy. The Americans weren't keen on the invasion of North Africa in 1942, Operation Torch. Their focus has always been, we need to get into Northwest Europe as quickly as possible with as many men as possible and head for Berlin. Churchill still believes in the indirect approach, this idea that the campaign in Italy could achieve two things. On the one hand, it offers the opportunity to push right up Italy and into the Balkans and into Eastern Europe, or failing that, that it will tie down large numbers of German troops on that front, and every soldier fighting in Italy is not potentially fighting in Normandy or in Russia. So what the Germans plan to do in terms of defence is very important to that political discussion, because if it's clear that they're not going to defend Italy very vigorously, then Churchill's argument is weakened because it's not as important. But it becomes apparent in discussions between Kesselring and Hitler that they are going to defend Italy very, very strongly. Hitler rather typically says, you know, no ground must be given up and that they must fight for every inch of soil. And Kesselring, he uses this dig, dig, dig phrase, which is the idea that German soldiers should create fortified positions and fight as tenaciously as possible. And from Churchill's point of view, that justifies the continuance of the campaign in Italy because you are wearing out the German army, tying up lots of troops, and generally making the operation in Normandy potentially easier.
So the ultra-intelligence that Churchill was able to see was only reinforcing that point of view that the Germans were, to some extent, struggling, that he was aware of their intentions, I suppose, as well as their
state. It reveals that they are struggling, but it also reveals that they intend to carry on struggling. They're not just going to suddenly up sticks to the Alps, which is what some people were perhaps naively hoping would happen. On a second level, the other thing that Lorenz is used for is for equipment states, for long messages containing administrative detail about the states of various German units. We'll see this again around the Normandy campaign. But for example, they would send things that we would consider nowadays a bit like a spreadsheet, which have how many soldiers they have, how many tanks they have, how many tanks they have under repair, you know, everything right down to how many pistols they have in some cases. So really, really detailed accounts of the equipment states of individual units. And what those allow is the Allied commanders in Italy to know in really intricate detail what they're facing, you know, how many Germans there will be in any one location, where their tanks are. And this allows them prior to the Anzio landing and after to really see in detail how many German forces have been distracted by the Anzio landing, how many are potentially fighting there, how many are on the front near Cassino, how many indeed have been withdrawn into reserve. And so, you know, they're seeing everything that Germans are doing in that way.
Is it possible that the Germans were as aware of Allied preparedness in this way, or is this an advantage that the Allies had through reading the traffic?
It's definitely an advantage that the Allies have that the Germans don't. The Germans, as we know more generally, were less successful in their signals intelligence operations. But also in Italy, Allied air superiority was growing all the time. And the Luftwaffe finds it harder and harder to fly reconnaissance operations over the Allied forces. So their picture of where Allied troops are is very, very poor. The other thing that happens is there is an ongoing deception operation where the Allies try to suggest that further amphibious operations are likely, that they're going to make more landings in the German rear. And they're able to see that the Germans are tying up quite a lot of troops in coastal defence in expectation of a potential Allied landing, both on the west coast and on the east coast of Italy, up sort of around Venice, that kind of area. They're worried that invasions will happen there. So not only are they being deceived, but they're finding it very, very difficult to find anything out about what their opponents' plans are. There's a definite advantage for the Allies in this theatre. And a lot of that is generated by Bletchley Park. Ralph Bennett, who wrote his book, Ultra and Mediterranean Strategy, analysed this in quite a lot of detail. And he focuses on late 1943, early 1944 as a real peak of success for Ultra, for Bletchley Park's efforts, both in Enigma and in Fish and traffic analysis and all the other tools they have at their disposal. He actually makes quite a striking remark. He says that Ultra counted Kesselring's tanks twice a week. And that gives you a real sense of the level of granular detail they had about the Germans and how up-to-date it was.
And the frequency of it too, the regularity of that information. Yeah. So Ultra Intelligence is showing where the Germans are. Did the Allies know what the Germans were planning to do?
On a tactical level, yes. This is the other thing that's really important, is Kesselring's messages are revealing what their strategies are to respond, both in Monte Cassino and at Anzio. And in fact, one of the critical moments in the campaign around Anzio is in mid-February, when the Germans had planned a major counterattack against the beachhead. There was one particular road leading to Anzio town, and they decided that they would throw a tank assault down this road and basically blow open the Allied beachhead. The problem they had was that the complete plan, down to how many tanks were involved in each wave, when it was going to happen, how it would be supplied, everything else, was read by Bletchley Park and was able to be sent out to commanders in Italy. So the commanders on the ground in Anzio were basically waiting for the attack. And as a result, it failed. And they were able to hold on in a way that, had it come as a surprise to them, you know, it would obviously have been much more difficult.
This was known as Operation Fishfang.
Operation Fishfang, yes. Which is actually just German for fishing. It's less exciting than it sounds. But as I say, the Germans are effectively fighting with one hand tied behind the back, because if everything they're planning to do is being read several days in advance, then they're obviously at a huge disadvantage.
Ultra Intelligence, it seems, made a really significant contribution to the Allies' plans. Did Bletchley Park make the difference?
It makes a difference. As always with intelligence, when we look at it from the Bletchley Park point of view, it's easy to assume that this was the answer and it made life easy. Actually, the campaign in Italy in the spring of 1944 is extremely brutal. The Germans still need fighting, and some of the troops that the Allies are facing are very, very high quality. There's a lot of German paratroops there, for example. The campaign as a whole cost the Allies nearly 100,000 casualties and 60,000 Germans. So it's always the way that intelligence can give you an advantage, but the battle still has to be fought. And this battle is so fierce, and the Germans are so well in place, that they really need every advantage they can get to make any progress at all.
It's spring here at Anzio, and under clear, warm skies, with the somehow unexpected sight of wild flowers carpeting the front line, we begin our fourth month ashore. Most people no longer live in foxholes. The men have used all the material to hand, with doors, beams from wrecked farms, and sometimes even steel girders, to get a solid roof over their heads. And the inevitable notices are appearing outside the front door. The better hole seems to be a favorite, with the addition, hawkers, bombs, and shells strictly prohibited. Still, the first prize goes to the Sergeant of the Army Kinematograph Unit, who's built a complete dugout cinema. He calls it the Anzio Ritz, seating 35 and emphatically no queuing. We've also had welcome visits from ENSA parties, and the men in one British division have formed their own concert party. And as the troops come out of the line, they have a hot shower and then a two-hour show from the Wagoners. The theatre's a disused and bomb-cracked shed, and the costumes are all homemade, but I can tell you that no actors have a more appreciative audience. Well, the other grand spring attractions are the Masked Pipers of the Beachhead, the Beachhead Rugby Final, and for one afternoon only, a brigade point-to-point and a donkey derby. Our food standard is going up as well. We've got a bakery going, and the Americans have set up a donut factory. And there's one machine turning out donuts within 2 miles of the front line.
Italy was not the only front. What was the situation in the Far East at this time?
The spring of 1944 is also a significant turning point in the Far East. And interestingly, from Bletchley Park's point of view, there's a direct connection between what's going on against the Japanese and what has been going on in Italy, because after the Italian armistice in September 43, all of the people who've been previously attacking Italian codes, and in particular reading Italian naval codes so effectively, kind of become redundant because there's no Italian codes to break anymore. So a lot of them are transferred over to do work on Japanese codes, and the Japanese operation at Bletchley grows quite significantly in the early part of 1944, with a lot of people being sent away to learn Japanese on Tiltman's famous course in Bedford, where they would teach some Japanese in 6 months, a form of Japanese that you needed to do code breaking in 6 months. It probably wasn't very useful for booking a hotel or having a chat.
I'm Stephen Freer, and I came to Bletchley first in 1941. I came from Trinity College at Cambridge. I was reading classics, so that was a good grounding for learning the rudiments of several other languages, such as Italian and Japanese. I went one day to the interview, which was in Oxford, and there for the first time I met Commander Denniston. And the summons to the interview had been sent to my home address, and sometimes in wartime the post was rather slow, so I didn't actually receive it at Cambridge until the morning of the day when I was supposed to be there. And I had just time to rush to the station and get the train by the little line which in those days led all the way from Cambridge to Oxford. But I was wearing my most untidy clothes, and I hadn't had time to have anything to eat and drink. So I was in quite a bad temper when I got to the interview. And I remember Commander Denniston asked me, amongst other things, whether I was at all air-minded. Well, I wasn't, and I said so. My two brothers were both very interested in aircraft, but it was a thing that had never appealed to me. And apparently this bluntness was a thing which impressed the interviewers, and they took me on. I went first to the training course in London, and my first day on the course was actually my 21st birthday. After a few weeks, the course was transferred to Bedford, and it was in June 1941 that I moved from Bedford to Bletchley. And I was working in the research section. The head of it then was Jerry Morgan, and we had various problems, but the one that I spent most time on was connected with the Italian naval ciphers, which used a Swedish machine, the Hagelin, and the messages were largely about the Mediterranean convoys taking supplies to the German army in North Africa. It was very exciting sometimes when we had seen a message about the convoys, and a day or two later we heard that they had been attacked by our air force. So we really felt that what we were doing was in fact having some effect on the war. The people that I met when I first came were people like Commander Denniston and John Tiltman, who was one of the greatest cryptographers. I never met Dilly Knox because he died very shortly after I came to Bletchley. I met Alan Turing because one time in our section we had a mathematical problem connected with probability which none of us could solve because we weren't really mathematicians. And we were told that Turing was the man who would solve it for us, and he did. He was a very shabby, untidy man. In all the published pictures, he must have been smartened up, I think, especially for the occasion. But his mind was absolutely brilliant. I worked mostly in the house at Bletchley. I spent a very short time in one of the huts, Hut 4, next to the house. But in the spring of 1942, Commander Denniston, who was in charge of the whole outfit at Bletchley, moved to London. He was moved rather like a queen bee taking a new swarm to a new place. And Bletchley was taken over by Commander Travis. In London, I worked under Norman Sainsbury, who was an expert in Oriental languages and later became the keeper of the Oriental manuscripts at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. We worked in an office in Berkeley Street, which before the war had been a hat shop called Peggy Carter. And some of the hats were still stored in the basement and in the attic of the building. And our fire officer was very alarmed because he thought that straw hats were just about the most dangerous thing as a fire risk that there could possibly be. And then there was an offshoot from Berkeley Street, where I worked for some time, in Aldford House in Park Lane. I was working there for the most part on Japanese diplomatic ciphers. We spent hours and hours copying things out and shuffling things to and fro to try to make them fit. And it was a great moment when we actually made the break and were able to read the messages. I was working at one time on a Japanese code book, which had a limitation. There were four-figure groups, and each group, the first three figures, were either all odd or all even. And this enabled us to work out a pattern so that we could set the messages in depth, which made it possible to break them. And then we could take the differences between the groups and find common differences, which were assumed to be differences between common groups. And so we could reduce all the various columns of our table to the same base, as it were. And then it was possible then, from there on, to start breaking the code book itself. The Japanese commercial attaché in Berlin seems to have invented a little cipher which was really almost a childish thing. And when we were working on it, we thought that it was really perhaps not worth the trouble of doing. However, when other business was slack for some reason, we thought we might as well tackle this potty little thing, and did so. And we were told afterwards that the messages had been shown to Winston Churchill himself, because the Japanese attaché gave an estimate of the amount of damage which we had done to German cities in the latter stages of the war, saying what percentage of each had been destroyed. And our people found it very interesting to compare the Japanese report with the reports which our bombers themselves had made.
Is it true that some people were just made familiar with the characters, whereas others were taught Japanese language?
Essentially, yes. And some of the Japanese code and cipher systems, you don't actually need to know any Japanese at all, really. This is because the code, as opposed to the ciphers, you have quite often numerical groups, four or five number groups, which represent different words in a dictionary, essentially. And to break those kind of codes, you only need to know that that string of five numbers represents the word ship. You don't need to know what the Japanese word for ship is. You can effectively conduct the process in English. That's not completely true, because they also use phonetic spellings of words and things like that, because obviously the dictionary that is the code book doesn't cover every eventuality. So messages will include things spelt out in Japanese as well as letter groups that represent words or phrases. But it means that the people who are involved in the code breaking process don't have to have an intimate command of Japanese. They have Japanese speakers on hand who they can kind of say, well, I've got 80% of the message, but there's this bit that I don't understand. And that's when they get the Japanese speaker in.
That's interesting as well. It's so different to this idea that there were language scholars from academic backgrounds working on this, and that it was solely down to their efforts, but actually people being taught from scratch as part of the Bletchley Park process.
Yes, being taught from scratch and being taught very specifically the particular linguistic knowledge they need for the job. We covered a lot of this, of course, in our episode Enter Japan, where we looked at Japanese codebreaking in more detail. What's significant in 1944, though, is that Bletchley Park is making a lot more progress with Army and Air Force material. And indeed, it's not just Bletchley Park, it's the various code-breaking operations that exist in the Far East itself. The Army had operations in India and in Sri Lanka that were involved with code-breaking kind of on-site, if you like. But the amount of work that's being done at Bletchley Park increases to the extent that in early 1944, they also set up an SLU. These are these units that are provided to military commanders to take intelligence from Bletchley really efficiently by a direct wireless link, essentially.
SLU stands for?
Special Liaison Unit. They set up an SLU in Delhi, which supplies General Slim, who's the army commander in India, with intelligence product from Bletchley. What this means is Bletchley is able to read huge amounts of Japanese traffic, the operations they're planning. From the Army point of view, also from an Air Force point of view, what air operations they're planning, aircraft movements. And this allows Slim to prepare for the upcoming Japanese operations. It also allows the Air Force in the Far East to attack the Japanese Air Force really, really effectively.
These are the news highlights of the moment. American bombers based in the Mediterranean area have made their fourth attack on German industries in Steyr in Austria.
Moscow dispatches say the hour of liberation is near for the Black Sea naval base of Odessa, with two powerful Russian armies closing in on the city along a 175-mile front. Radio France at Algiers, without confirmation from Allied headquarters, reports that a force of British and American commandos have raided the German-held island of Salta in the Adriatic, off the port of Split. Our men are said to have captured 111 Germans and destroyed many installations, among them a wireless station. The French broadcast gives no details on the size of the attacking force. From Burma, Allied headquarters reports that small parties of Japanese have succeeded in cutting the important Imphal-Koyma road at several places, some 60 miles north of Imphal. A headquarters statement says the Japs are evidently trying to make a major cut in that road and make it stick, thus blocking the entire British network of land communications between central Burma and India. There are other reports, unofficial, that the Japs have cut the Ukro Road. Ukro itself is 32 miles to the northeast of Imphal. Allied planes continue to hammer the Japs over a wide front, and heavy bombers have started large fires at a railway station in Rangoon. We're also told that the Allied troops who landed by glider deep in Burma several weeks ago under command of the late General Wingate had to stop their air operations for a few days to battle Jap troops which had infiltrated to the perimeter of the Allied airstrip. But the enemy has now been cleared out of the sector and air operations are continuing.
The SLU was providing Janoslin with intelligence. Were they also intercepting Japanese transmissions, or was that done elsewhere?
It's not done by the SLU, but there are Y stations of various kinds in India, in Sri Lanka, in East Africa, and also in Australia. There's a variety of intercept operations run by the British, by the Americans, and by the Australians in various parts of the Far East. The cooperation between them isn't brilliant. Some of the key personalities on the American side are quite reluctant to share material with the Australians or indeed the British. But some of the stuff we're talking about today in relation to Burma, those ciphers were attacked by Bletchley, and the material was also able to be intercepted by British Y stations in India. So it was less under the influence of the Americans than some of the other aspects of the operations in the Far East.
What was the strategic situation in Burma then?
In the spring of 1944, Burma has fallen almost entirely to the Japanese. And the Japanese are hoping that they can go on to invade eastern India. Ultimately, their mission is to take over British India almost entirely. And indeed, they are raising units of Indian troops. And they've been talking to a number of the members of the Indian independence movement that had existed from the 1930s. There are a couple of individuals who rather notoriously support Japanese efforts to kind of subvert the population of India to rise against the British. It never happens, and indeed huge numbers of Indians fight in the Indian army against the Japanese, so that's not a realistic prospect. At the same time, though, a Japanese invasion of northeastern India would be a setback for the Allies, and Slim's ultimate mission is also to recapture Burma, recapture Malaya, and at the end of that peninsula, if you get far enough, is Singapore, of course. So Britain and the Allies are really keen to get back on the front foot in that part of the world and start pushing the Japanese back. Where Bletchley comes in March of 1944, the Japanese develop their plan to invade northeastern India. This is an operation that goes under the code name Ugo, and their plan is to launch attacks through the mountain passes that lead down into India in that area. Due to the work done at Bletchley, Slim is able to be kept abreast of the Japanese planning for this operation and prepare for it to a certain extent. He still doesn't have huge numbers of troops with which to face it, but he is forewarned of the attack. What happens in the event is that the Japanese attack through the passes in the mountains, and the passes in the mountains are defended by British and Indian troops. Famously, Kohima, which is a small sort of administrative outpost up in the mountains, was the scene of very, very bitter fighting for a number of weeks. And because it sat astride the main road into India, the Japanese had to capture it. The fighting there was really intense and very, very close. Kohima is famous for its tennis court because the British and Indian forces were dug in on one side of the tennis court and the Japanese were dug in on the other side. And that situation prevailed for quite some time, and it gives you a sense of just the closeness and the intensity of the fighting. And casualties on both sides were very, very severe. So, like we were saying about Italy, the intelligence advantage is an advantage, but it doesn't mean people don't have to fight very, very bitterly. Mm. Fortunately for the Allies, at this point, the Japanese, while their ambition is still very strong, they still believe that they can invade India and expand their empire ever further. The reality of Japanese military power is that it is dwindling at this point. Their forces are very, very stretched. Their supplies of all kinds, food, ammunition, manpower, are waning. So although the offensive begins with high hopes on the Japanese side, it becomes apparent that they're very stretched and they can't really maintain the attack. And ultimately, later in the year, the Japanese attack runs out of steam and Slim is able to launch the reinvasion of Burma and start to liberate the British possessions in the Far East and ultimately defeat the Japanese.
India's Minister of Information says, "We have trapped the enemy in the Imphal area. He must either withdraw or be annihilated." These pictures from the Assam-Burma border take us into the hills of Manipur, where men of the 5th and 7th Indian Divisions are in action. The main fighting has so far occurred along the roads, where the Japanese have sprung out of the jungle in force at several key points and attempted to establish roadblocks to prevent us from concentrating our forces against him. Tanks, artillery, and infantry are in process of knocking the enemy before he has time to become established. This is any man's country. Large opposing forces can wander for scores of miles without ever meeting each other. But when they meet, it becomes a massacre. Japanese corpses are strewn thickly where they fell after being caught in a merciless crossfire from infantry and tanks. They have no further interest in Tojo's gamble. For them, it has meant death in a strange jungle 3,000 miles from Tokyo.
How were the Allies aware of the Japanese situation? You've mentioned numerical groups of codes and you spoke about the JN-25 Navy code. How else were they becoming aware of the Japanese situation and the Japanese strategy?
Well, they're listening to army codes, but they're also very successful against the Japanese Air Force. Japanese Air Force is using simpler cipher systems. In particular, they have a three-digit code, which is given the code name Bulbul, which I believe is a type of bird. And Bletchley was able to read that with great frequency. One of the things the Japanese are doing is, because of the nature of the terrain in Burma, they're not keeping their air force close to the front line. A lot of their air power is retained in Thailand and then is flown forward to intermediate bases when they want to launch an attack. The problem with this is that the communications that they make before they fly the bombers forward means that the Allies and Slim gets notice that these attacks are about to happen. And the intercepts become so reliable that the Allied air forces are able to intercept the bombers, not even on their bombing missions over the British and Allied troops, but actually on their transit flights from Thailand into Burma. And there's one occasion when I believe an entire squadron of Japanese bombers are shot down because they know exactly where they're going to be and they just intercept them and destroy them all.
Did things like that not give the game away, that intelligence was being gathered almost as this was happening?
It might have done. That's always a risk with these kind of operations. A more famous example is when the Japanese Admiral Yamamoto was flying down in the Philippines, and actually the Americans knew of his journey through code breaking. And they took the decision to shoot his individual aircraft down and kill him as a sort of assassination mission. People have called that into question on sort of moral grounds as much as anything. But also it's a very risky thing to do from an intelligence point of view, because the Japanese are obviously going to go, they shot his plane down. How did they know he was in that plane? Fortunately, the Japanese believed that it was a combination of kind of either human intelligence, either spies on the ground or blind luck. And the codes weren't compromised. But every time you conduct these operations, you have to make that judgment about, you know, is the benefit of the individual operation greater than the risk of compromising what you're doing?
The famous Hurricane, which turned the scales in the Battle of Britain, has just gone out of production. But this old warrior is still doing fine work on the Burma front. These men are taking off for a special mission, demanding pinpoint precision bombing. Intelligence officers have learned that between 50 and 60 Japanese are hiding in the heart of the jungle. You may be sure that when they are finished with it, there'll be precious little of this particular refuge left to the enemy. These converted Hurricanes, now called Hurry Bombers, carry two 500-pound bombs tucked beneath the wings. Down there, somewhere in that tangled wilderness, lies their target, or rather, that's where their target lay. After this heavy pounding, there'll not be much hospitality left in it for the Japanese invader. Over these rugged mountains our planes go to carry the battle to the enemy. The attack is taken up by the infantry. The enemy has been forced to run and leave behind a vast array of equipment. Among the booty is a Japanese flag, the rising sun. But the Jap sun is setting as our men force their way along the rain-soaked roads defying the monsoon to hurl back the invader and shatter his dream of conquest in India.
The US and the British code-breaking effort, was that really closely combined then when dealing with the Japanese side of things?
It was more in parallel than combined. As I was saying earlier, some of the Americans were quite reluctant to share what they were doing. And the other problem was that because of where their troops were, they were doing the lion's share of the interception. And there were various agreements between the British and the Americans and the Australians that different material that was intercepted by different sides would be swapped over. And also on the naval side, JN-25 is a code book that contains many thousands of entries with numerical groups referring to different words and phrases. There's also the additive book, as it's called, because you have a whole series of random numbers that you add to the number in the dictionary to create the final coded message. And so both the British and the Americans were trying to identify groups in the additive book and groups in the code book itself. And due to the nature of the traffic they were looking at, sometimes one side would have found out some words in the book that the other side didn't know and vice versa. So it tended to be that they would work separately, but every few days they would exchange the results of their efforts. So the Allies had a copy of the Japanese JN-25 codebook. Some of the groups in it they deciphered for themselves, and others they'd been provided with by the Americans.
So that liaison then helped the joint effort?
It helps the joint effort, but it's not ideal. I mean, you wouldn't do it the way they did it if you had a choice from the start. But it does succeed to a substantial degree. And indeed, that JN-25 work was done very near to where we're sitting here in Block B, Bletchley Park.
I was going to ask about Bletchley Park. You said that a lot of the people working on the Italian codes and ciphers were moved across to Japanese. How many people, approximately, were working on Japanese codes and ciphers at Bletchley Park at this time? Was it tens, hundreds?
It's hundreds. It becomes a very large proportion of the other work that's being done. I mean, we think about, you know, Enigma and Fish as a big lump of work. The other big lump of work is Japanese in all its forms, Naval, Army and Air Force. And a lot of it happens in Block F on the site here, to the extent that Block F was a very large building, like all the buildings at Bletchley, a spine corridor that ran all the way down it. And the Japanese Air Force code breaking took place at the far end, which meant that the nickname for the main corridor of Block F was the Burma Road, because it was very long and it was all dealing with Japanese code breaking.
Has a lot of information been revealed? Has a lot been published about the Japanese side of the story at Bletchley Park?
Not as much as has been published on the German story. One of the things we're hoping to develop as we go forward is more information about the Japanese side of things, because it's a very important part of the work done here. It was half the war. Part of the problem has been that the American story in terms of breaking Japanese codes broke into the public domain very, very quickly after the Second World War. One of the reasons for that was Pearl Harbor was such a shock to the Americans that there was a congressional inquiry into why they weren't more prepared when the Japanese attacked. And obviously a big part of that story relates to code breaking and intelligence with regards to the Japanese plans. What that meant was in the late 40s and early 50s, a lot of information came out about American efforts to break Japanese codes. The British, on the other hand, even though they were an equal partner in that process, kept quiet about their involvement in the story. And so a lot of the people at Bletchley who worked on Japanese traffic would have had to put up with the fact that the story was told from a very much an American perspective for many, many years.
Whilst respecting the Official Secrets Act as well here.
It's only in the last few years and since the Enigma story broke as well, since the Bletchley Park story came out more generally, that the record has been gradually set straight about what was being done here against the Japanese as well. And there are a number of important successes against particular Japanese code and cipher systems. Our own oral history program here has been able to talk to a number of veterans who worked on Japanese traffic, including some of the people who started out doing Italian. So we know quite a bit about the experience of people here. One of the people I spoke to at length last year was a veteran called Edward Simpson, who has been a strong supporter of Bletchley Park since it opened in the 1990s. And he worked on JN-25, the Japanese naval code, in Block B, very near to where we were sitting. I had the privilege last year of getting him in for a video interview, and he talked at length about the exact way you go about identifying these individual code groups. I'm glad it's on video because I'm not convinced I completely understood it while he was explaining it. But he had certainly lost none of his expertise in it. He was able to describe what sounded like an extraordinarily tedious and unrewarding process in great, great detail.
Incredible memory in that case to remember it all in that detail.
It was an incredible memory. And we were fortunate to be able to talk to him because sadly he died about 2 weeks ago now, back at the end of January. So he'll be sadly missed in terms of the Japanese story. But hopefully we captured a lot of his memories when we spoke to him last year.
When the Italian war finished in August of 1943, the Italian section was left virtually with nothing to do. And the great majority of us were transferred on to work against the Japanese ciphers. I was surprised but very pleased to be asked whether I would lead the team that was going to work on one of the biggest of the Japanese naval ciphers, which was called JN-25, JN for Japanese Naval. I think it's just worth mentioning courses in Japanese language. Of course, nobody in the cryptanalysis business needed to understand the full subtleties of Japanese language. What we needed was the language of Japanese naval signals, which was very different. Obviously, once Japan came into the war on Germany's side, there was going to be a need for Japanese linguists. Bletchley Park had a few who were already well into the Japanese language, but that was nothing like enough. The School of Oriental and African Studies in London told Tilghman that it would take 2 years to train up a linguist for his purposes. But Tilghman hadn't got 2 years, but he got advice that it could be done in 6 months. He got Captain Tuck, who was presumably already a buddy of his and had long experience in the Far East, to come and take charge of the course. And he then approached tutors in a number of Oxford and Cambridge colleges who recommended to him young men who might be able to take on this challenge. And they and Captain Tuck came together in Bedford and embarked on the 6 months course. It was a huge success and a tribute to the judgment that it could be done in 6 months. I mentioned just as one illustration of the success, Marjorie Dale was the only woman on the first of these. Sometime later, her opposite numbers in Washington were so impressed by her skill that they took for granted that she had grown up in Japan. And when they were told that, no, she'd done a 6 months course, they were lost in admiration. Bletchley Park also organized a 1 month course for people who needed a certain amount of language, but nothing like the same detail. And the first of these started in the first week of September of 1943, very quickly indeed. The 1 month courses were taken by John Lloyd, who was a civilian, had been a consular official in Tokyo. And there were, from memory, five of us on his first course, as well as Rebecca and myself. There was Hugh Thurston, who had been a mathematician in the Italian section, Murray Macbeth, who was a mathematician from my own maths department in Queen's Belfast, and Colin Thompson, who had run the haggling. And we did that for 1 month. The team that we set up to work on the JN-25 cipher was, in the first instance, entirely people who had been in the Italian section, and very much the younger ones. We were not starting entirely from scratch. JN-25 was, again, basically a subtractor system. And so it had a good deal in common with the Libya, which we had worked on in the Italian section. And that was a good start. And of course, other people, particularly the Americans in Washington, the outfit called OP-20G, and also people in Australia, were way ahead of us in experience. We were never going to be their equal, that for two main reasons. One was simply the number of persons that we had at our disposal. One of the senior Washington US Navy people, Commander Wenger, was in Bletchley Park in July of 1943 at this formative time, and he told Bletchley Park that they had 700 people working on the recovery of JN-25 alone, and that they hoped to raise this to 1,000. Our party started with 20 and stayed at 20 for a year, and the biggest we ever got after we were able to recruit, as people gradually became available from the European war, was 45 was our maximum figure. So clearly we were not in the same game as Washington. Our second limitation was on what we technically called the traffic, that is the enciphered messages as taken down out of the air. The British receiving station at Flowerdown, in spite of the distance halfway around the globe, was able to record a certain amount of Japanese traffic, and that was great, but it was less than a fifth of the total available. The large quantities of traffic recorded either on the American West Coast or even in the American Pacific Islands came to us in paper form by diplomatic bag about twice a week, but 2 or 3 weeks late. And that was, of course, a huge handicap which we were never able to overcome. At one point, I remember, we said to Washington very politely, would you like to cable us the raw material, and then we could get it hugely sooner? To which, and I'm sure they were entirely justified in this, they said no. So we were stuck with this situation on the supply of raw material. Now, it's obvious that where there were chunks of this material that could be fairly easily solved, Washington would themselves have solved it long before the raw material ever reached us. Cable was used to exchange recovered, solved additives. So we didn't waste our time starting on what we knew they had already solved. What we couldn't foresee, and this sometimes did lead to disappointment and frustration, was that we might have what we considered a very good day and recovered a lot of additives and sent them off happily to Washington, saying, in effect, look what we've got, only to find that the following day their cabling, their recoveries to us, would include what we had just found and a lot more besides. And you couldn't help being disappointed by that. But we swallowed it and carried on.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.